Welcome to Straight Up, brought to you by Peak Prosperity, which values context, curiosity, and learning that leads to action. Reading from his latest works and expanding on current events in the economy, energy, and environment, it is my pleasure to introduce your host, Dr. Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this, well, I'd call it a podcast, but what I'm going to do here is I'm going to read out my most recent piece of writing. And so this is part one. This is called The Company Store. It leaves almost nothing to live on. You know, in the song 16 Tons by Merle Travis and made famous by Tennessee Ernie Ford, the idea of the company store referred to a system of debt bondage that effectively trapped workers within an unfair system designed to harvest all of their labor at a very low cost. Here's that song. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. Now, how exactly did the company store system operate? Here's a quote from Wiki. Quote, under a script system, workers were not paid cash. Rather, they were paid with non-transferable credit vouchers that could be exchanged only for goods sold at the company store. This made it impossible for workers to store up cash savings. Workers also usually lived in company-owned dormitories or houses, the rent for which was automatically deducted from their pay, end quote. This model was simple enough to understand. Pay your workers with script vouchers, then sell them your marked-up goods at the company store, pocketing a nice profit. On top of that, force your employees to live in company housing, too, also at terms very favorable to the company. Add it all up, and the workers found themselves in perpetual service to their employer. No matter how hard and long they toiled, there was nothing left for their own private benefit after all was said and done. The company succeeded in skimming off any and all of the excess for itself. This vast unfairness eventually led to the formation of unions as well as to regulations providing protection to the workers. However, capital never sleeps, and the human temptation to skim and take what they can for themselves is a constant in every hierarchical post-agriculture society. If the idea of the company store was too obvious, then a better method of achieving the same outcome had to be hatched. Something with sufficient additional complexity to defeat the ability of the average worker to detect the nature of the scam. The financialization of the company store. Which brings us to today's so-called financial markets, or markets, as I prefer to refer to them, because they don't actually represent a free and fair system where prices are set fairly. The scam today that's enabled by these markets is every bit as egregious as the company store of old, only today's victims are mostly blind to the way that the system is rigged against them. It's just sophisticated enough that it mostly evades detection, or is diffuse enough that even if the scam were detected by a participant, whom would they protest against? The markets? The exchanges? Any of the thousands of funds or private money institutions that are feasting off the system? It's a genius setup. The harvesting is every bit of a violation as the old model, but it's almost impossible to prosecute. The main losers in this battle, as before, are the primary producers of value, those who labor to extract the primary wealth of the earth and bring it to market. The farmers, the ranchers, the fishermen, the loggers, the miners, and the refiners. Farmageddon. Let's illustrate how this works for farmers, or rather, works against them. The price of any commodity is now set in the financial markets, principally within the futures market, where paper contracts are bought and sold by three main participants. Producers, that's the farmers, consumers, ag and food companies, and speculators. In a free and fair world, the price of a commodity should reflect the actual supply and demand for its derived products. We should observe some sort of relationship between the primary source of wealth, the corn, the wheat, and soybeans, for example, and the end food products that consumers buy in the store. Now, I'm going to show you a bunch of commodity data that goes back to the late 1990s. So let's start here. Inflation has advanced 56% since 1998, according to the BLS, and has increased 60% for food as a subcomponent. And here, I've got a little graph in here which uses the CPI inflation calculator that the BLS puts out showing that data. Now, this, of course, is a low-end estimate of how far food has actually advanced in price due to inflation over the past 20 years, as the CPI persistently underestimates inflation. Turning now to the farmer, how have the prices received for their products fared over that same stretch of time? In the case of corn, not one single bit. A bushel of corn sells for the exact same nominal price today as it did back in 1996. Now, think of all the input costs a farmer has to pay to run his or her farm. In 1998, oil traded at $11.61 per barrel on average. Today, its cost is 390% higher than that. At our recent annual seminar in Sebastopol, California, April 26th to 28th this year, a gentleman from Nebraska informed me that the cost of a bushel of seed corn has advanced from $40 to over $400 during that time frame. Fertilizers are much more expensive versus 20 years ago. So are tractors, farmland itself, water, you name it. Every single farm input cost has risen strongly over the few decades. But the price of corn is exactly the same as it was 23 years ago. Meanwhile, the consumer has seen the price of a box of cornflakes increase by 44% on average since 1998, from $2.29 per 18-ounce box to $3.28. Now, how do farmers survive this squeeze on their already tiny profit margins? How do they cope with flat prices for corn and huge increases in input costs? One way is by abusing their soil, using GMOs, heavy fertilizer and herbicide applications, and other tricks to squeeze as much short-term productivity out of every acre they can. But beyond these productivity improvements, which eventually hit a point of diminishing returns, what else can a producer do with rising costs and flat revenue? Well, they can go deeper into debt. And here I have a chart in the printed article which shows from the St. Louis Federal Reserve showing mortgage debt outstanding by type of property, this in this case farm, went from about $80 billion in the mid-1990s to over $250 billion. Huge increase. In the above chart is a farm mortgage debt. The total farm debt across all credit instruments hit a new record in 2018 of more than $409 billion. Today's remaining farmers are forced to take on more and more risk, and that's expressed in the amount of debt they're carrying. Next, I'm going to show you a table here for Nebraska that details the plight. Note that while net farm income remained relatively flat between 2002 and 2015, which is the term of this table, it goes from those 2 years, family living expenses have exploded in parallel with total farm debt. So what we're looking at here in this table is we're seeing that in 2002, net farm income was $25,000. In 2015, it was $29,000. That's the net farm income. So this is an average. From that same period of time, though, 2002, family living expenses exploded from $36,700, call that $37,000, to over $91,000. So living expenses almost triple. Total farm debt on a per farm basis went from $413,000 to over $1 million. You add that all up, and yes, the accrual gross income also exploded from $395,000 to $954,000 per farm. But when we express as a percentage of revenue, the net profit margins of farms have plunged from 6.3% to just 3%. That's a really skinny margin, which leaves little room for error. One bad season and all the reserves are chewed up, and then some. Here's a quote. More than half of U.S. farm households lost money farming in recent years, according to the USDA, which estimated that the median farm income for U.S. farm households was negative $1,548 in 2018. Negative $1,548 for the median income. Continuing the quote, farm incomes have slid despite record productivity on American farms because oversupply drives down commodity prices, end quote. You see that narrative in play? There is farm oversupply. If that were the case, then food prices would come down to bring supply and demand into equilibrium, but that's not happening. Instead, the farmers eat those losses. The median income was negative territory. But the rest of the food delivery chain keeps its prices intact and pockets the difference. Now, our farmers work exceptionally hard, labor-intensive jobs to produce an absolutely essential input to human life. And yet somehow, when all is said and done, they're left with barely more for their efforts than the coal miners trapped in the system of the company store. Take away a little bit of complexity, and it's the same exploitative system as before, it's just a little less obvious. And instead of a company foreman or owner to rail against, the perpetrators are much more obscure and shadowy. The scam. The principle of any scam is the same as for any successful parasite. Take as much as you can, but leave the host somewhat alive. Here's how the modern company store scam works. First, you have to convince everyone that money has value, and that value is very real. Make people crave it and work for it, and take away all their property and belongings if they run out of it. Do this long enough to reinforce the idea that money is everything. You either have it or you don't. It needs to be regarded as tangible and essential. At the other end of the spectrum for the big players, print up and distribute as much digital money as needed by the big players to run their various schemes and scams. If they ever get in big trouble, make up a fancy sounding name like TARP or TELF or QE, and then talk about how you had to do it to save the system to prevent a systemic crisis. Next, be sure that your regulators are unable, through incompetence and or neglect, to detect price manipulation in the financial markets, even under the most egregious of circumstances. No matter how obvious such manipulation is, it's vital that no investigations be undertaken, and if they are, that they take many years to conduct and come to the conclusion that no wrongdoing happened. Finally, allow an unmanageable swamp of high-frequency computer algorithms to take over securities trading, creating a system that is so complex, so secretive, and so ripe for fraud and abuse that nobody can unravel the complexity to detect that a scam is even running. Using this ecosystem of legalized theft, then have the various crooks involved monkey the prices of key commodities to levels that, surprise, leave hardly any breathing room for the farmers, miners, loggers, and refiners to live within. Now that the scam has been exposed, the appropriate question to ask is, if the producers aren't getting the benefit of the labor, then who is? The people running this scam, the financiers, the bankers, and their moneyed clients are the beneficiaries. They make oodles of money while performing no real work and taking very little real risk, same as any other natural-born parasite. The abuse is widespread. In case you think that I cherry-picked corn as an example, particularly favorable to my case, I assure you I didn't. Here are several key commodities suffering the same abuse. First, I have a chart here of soybeans, showing that soybeans have the exact same price per bushel that they did in 1997. Wheat has the exact same price per bushel that it did in 1996. And then I have a chart of silver. Regarding the above chart of silver, there are two important factors to note here. First, it's practically impossible to get better at mining silver, like we might improve, say, farm productivity, because the ore grades have been declining each year as companies burn through their very best ores in a quest to remain alive. And from that alone, we'd expect to see prices climbing higher over long stretches of time, like shown in this chart. And second, the business is really very energy and capital intensive, yet silver is now at the same price as it was back in 2006, 13 years ago. I go into this in greater depth in part two. Silver is an amazing commodity with some really extraordinary investment opportunities in front of it. And I, in this chart, I circle a large, long orange oval that shows a decade of pure price suppression that many miners did not survive through the 90s and early 2000s. This tells us that these scams have been alive and well for a really long time. The bitter conclusion. Run this scam long enough, and one day we'll discover that the banks and their proxy agents, private equity funds, hedge funds, endowments, family offices, etc., own all the productive farmland, all the mines, all the oil wells, and all of the timberland, and every other means of primary wealth production. The former farm and mine owners will be offered roles as managers or other types of tenant-farmer arrangements, essentially working for whatever income the labor market can see fit to provide. It won't be much. At that point, the entire economy will have become a company store. We're well on our way there. The Federal Reserve prints up oodles of money, and it goes into the financial system, which is a code phrase for to the big banks and big money outfits, and they in turn use these funds to make loans to the primary producers on the one hand, and to drive down the price of commodities with the other hand. Eventually, the farmer has a bad couple of years, and his farm is foreclosed on. The land goes up for auction and is bought by the highest bidder, which means the buyer with the most money. That increasingly means a big money type that feasts at the trough of the banking system slash money printing machine. Next thing you know, vast swaths of farmland magically end up in the hands of those with money, which, surprised again, turns out usually to be the same entities feasting on the central bank free money machine that's been operating ever since Alan Greenspan set up this slow motion train wreck process in the late 1990s. Here's a quote from an article. The headline is "Who Really Owns American Farmland?" is from July 31st, 2017. Quote, "The answer, increasingly, is not American farmers. Today, the USDA estimates that at least 30% of American farmland is owned by non-operators who lease it out to farmers. And with a median age for the American farmer of about 55, it's anticipated that in the next 5 years, some 92 million acres will change hands, with much of it passing to investors rather than traditional farmers. But what about the people, often tenant farmers, who actually work the land being acquired? During the same period that farmland prices started gaining steam, many crop prices have stagnated or fallen. After hitting highs above $8 a bushel in 2012, corn prices today have fallen back to less than $4 a bushel, what they were about 10 years ago, in 2007, when farmland prices first started to soar. Quick edit, it's the same as they also were in 1996, excuse me. Continuing the quote, "It's a tenuous predicament, growing low-cost food, feed, and fuel on more expensive land. It raises a host of questions. Is this a sustainable situation? What happens to small farmers?" End quote. Aging farmers, increasing ownership of farmland by financial investors, and utterly dismal economics. Hey, what's not to love? The sorry conclusion to all this is that one day, not too far away, we'll wake up and discover that the majority of U.S. farmland belongs to mega corporations and financial interests, most of whom came across their vast gobs of wealth as a consequence, and a predictable one at that, of Federal Reserve policy that spurred today's great wave of financialization. An explosion in farmland prices really kicked into high gear with the Fed's quantitative easing or QE programs following the Great Recession. Freshly printed money that wound up in the hands of financial firms and interests with few good ideas of where to put it, so some of it leaked over into farmland. The same dynamic has seen firms like BlackRock tap into ultra-cheap Fed money to buy vast swaths of U.S. housing stock just to rent back to the same people who couldn't compete against this Leviathan's all-cash offers using money that was 75% cheaper than the terms regular borrowers received. Big money coupled to cheap money leads to this outcome every time. Eventually, you wake up and discover, with a few clicks on a keyboard, that the bankers and financiers have taken possession of every productive asset, and everybody else has to pay into the company store. And this isn't an accident either, which is why it really galls me to have Janet Yellen, the former Fed chair, out there for years. For years, she's been out there making the ludicrous claim that the Federal Reserve is not political. What could possibly be more political than enabling the removal of the productive assets of a nation, its land, its houses, its mineral rights, and facilitating and cheering their acquisition by a very tiny financial elite? That's practically the most political act there is. More tragically, it's just a gussied up version of working for the company store. We've gone backwards, and not in a good way. As one tragic story in a recent article went, quote, "It was Sunday in April 2017, when a queasy feeling in Daryl Crapp's stomach sent him rushing home. He found his wife, Deanna, lying crumpled on the floor of their Lancaster, Wisconsin bathroom. She had swallowed a handful of pills. Overwhelmed with debt and with little prospect of turning a profit that year, the Crapps knew BMO Harris Bank wouldn't lend them any money to plant. The bank had frozen the farm's checking account. Mrs. Crapp managed the fifth-generation corn, cattle, and hog farm's books. She had stayed up nights drafting dozens of budgets to try and stave off disaster, including 30-day, 60-day, and 90-day budgets. It was too much for her, Mr. Crapp, 63, said of his wife, who survived the incident. Crapp Farms filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy the next month with a total debt of $36 million. In a written statement, Patrick O'Harely, a BMO spokesman, said the bank doesn't comment on specific customer relationships but strives to, quote, approach every situation with empathy and to help our customers manage challenging financial situations. He said the bank had been working in the agricultural sector for more than a century and was committed to the industry. At its height, Mr. Crapp and his two sons had grown crops on 17,000 acres. The farm's last 197 acres, homesteaded by Mr. Crapp's ancestors in the 1860s, will likely be auctioned off this month. Mr. Crapp now sells farmland for a regional realty company and helps run the family's trucking business, which transports grain and livestock feed for area farmers. His younger son drives trucks for the company. His older son repairs grain storage bins. Mr. Crapp said he would have to file bankruptcy again, likely under Chapter 12, to discharge his remaining debts. "We haven't won very many battles," said Mr. Crapp. "The bank pretty much owns us." End quote. That's straight up the 2019 version of the 16 tons refrain, "I owe my soul to the company store." What the politicians, financial institutions, and Federal Reserve are defending and supporting is a system that utterly lacks in integrity and is strikingly heartless. If we want to create a world worth inheriting, and I do, that means we cannot afford a system that forces farmers to fight for their very livelihoods each and every year, barely hanging on, and forced to cut costs to even survive. Cutting costs and boosting farm productivity means more pesticides, less soil building and resting, fewer crop varieties, and every other measure of health and complexity upon which our very survival as a species depends, all in service of money. That's the end of part one. In part two, titled "It's Time to Respond," we detail why it's so pressing right now to mobilize into action. The opportunity, such as it is for us to first recognize this game for what it is, it's rigged, and to take steps to escape the smothering squeeze of financialization being applied to all of us in today's economy, and then to realign our own actions with the future we wish to see. Thank you for listening.